You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Hey, where did we go? Days when the rain came.
We continue. And one of the cool things about doing this is meeting different people who you cross paths with and who have interesting stories themselves. And you're going to meet one of them here right now. Mike Archer joins us. And so, Mike, first of all, good morning. How are you?
I'm great, Mac. How are you this morning?
I'm all right. First of all, before we can have a conversation, we have to know if we can believe you or if you're just another Marine that's full of shit, all right? So
90% believable, I think.
All right. We'll judge that like all Marines do. You know what? The best part of that little everybody knows it's true, though, right? Marines, it's like, what? Like, who is he? Like, why am I listening to him? So Marines have no problem with it. It's like it's just part of the gig. Let's learn about you, Mike. Born and raised where?
I was born and raised in Oakland, California, and to a middle class Irish Catholic family. Went to parochial school most of my life, and my father and my brother were in the Marine Corps, and so it was kind of destined, I guess, that I would be there too.
So tell me, your dad, World War II guy or what?
Yeah, he was. He was an engineer in the Marines in the South Pacific. He was got in about 43 and was in on the invasion of Guam and was on a few of the other islands, Kwajalein and a few places like that. And my brother was in Vietnam. He was 2 years older than me. He was by the time I graduated from high school, he was in the elite First Force Recon Company.
Oh.
And he was injured in Vietnam, but not too seriously.
Injured wounded, injured jumping, injured falling, injured...
Yeah, it was on a recon insertion. He was a radio operator like I was. I don't know why that ran in the family, but he jumped out of a radio into some tall grass and with all his gear and broke his ankle.
Not an uncommon story. It happens. Especially top heavy radio operators. So you joined the Marine Corps in what year?
I enlisted in April of 67, went to boot camp in early June.
Okay. And, you just graduated from high school? Had you been out of high school?
Yeah, I'd been out of high school since 66. I was working as a truck driver and, just on a, on a whim, I guess, I hadn't received draft notice, but, I was talking with a buddy of mine, Tom Mahoney, who was the subject of my last book, by the way. And he said, let's join up. Let's go. And so we just headed down to the recruiter the next morning, and I signed up for 3 years.
That's a little bit of a lie. You know, what's amazing, though, when you talk to people about their stories is, if you wait 3 months, right, you're not a caisson. Your whole life is different. And how,
wow.
And right, and how the decisions that we make in life echo through. So you join the Marine Corps and you get through boot camp. You've been mentally prepared or at least teased about boot camp your entire life. Give me a thought as you went through boot camp.
I wasn't really squared away. I had a kind of an adolescent chip on my shoulder, and it took about 4 weeks. To get squared away and but I progressed slowly and I was a skinny guy and I guess it was at a fuel stick range about two thirds of the way through we had it was bayonet training and we had a lot of technique shown us by a trainer on the range and when it got to be my turn to go up to the line to face off against a Marine and another platoon I just grabbed the end of the stick and just started beating the hell out of him, and he went down, and I kicked him, and so they threw me off the range, and as I was jogging away, I thought, oh, boy, I'm going to be in the pits for the rest of my life, and my drill instructor, Staff Sergeant Reynolds, had looked over at me and whispered, they were betting cigarettes, by the way, on a platform, betting cigarettes on who was going to win, and he leaned over to me, and he'd been riding me pretty hard, leaned over to me and said, nice work, son, and I think at that moment, that's the day I knew I was going to make it through boot camp.
the things they enjoy. Interesting, right? The it has no small impact on you. So how do you get? Are you just a smart guy? That's how you get the. That's how you become a communicator. Is that what runs in the family?
You know, that crossed my mind as soon as I received my orders for radio school. I don't know. Maybe the Irish have a gift for gab or something. I always used to say, but I don't know. It was strange that both my brother and I have the same MOS.
So when do you finish school? When do you head to the fleet?
Okay, I got stuck. This was the worst part of my Marine Corps, even considering Kaysan and other places in
the I was going to say, this better be a pretty incredible event if you preface it with, this is the worst, a guy from Kaysan says, this was the worst part of my Marine Corps experience.
I think most Marines will agree with me. I got stuck on mess duty for a month before I could go home on leave. And hated it, worst month of my life. But anyway, so I went home on leave and went back to staging battalion, ran a few of these patrols that were very discouraging because, you know, you'd walk through these mock patrols and at the end, you know, your instructors would show you half a dozen booby traps you missed. So, you know, none of us had any high expectations by that time. But, yeah, I arrived in Vietnam on December 6th and was fortunate or unfortunate enough to catch an immediate flight up to Kaysan on a C-123.
So you're December 6th, 1967?
Yes.
All right. And then you get on a flight and you join the battalion already at Kaysan.
Right. I was there was a regiment. There was one battalion, but there was also a regimental company there, 26 Marines.
Right.
And so I joined them as a member of the Tactical Air Control Party, the air team in the Fire Support Coordination Center.
Nice. So tell us about, we've heard all kinds of people on movies talking about, and I've never interviewed anybody that's flown in to Kaysan as a augment or a replacement, but I've heard the stories watching videos of them briefing you, hey, the plane's not going to stop, we're going to throw the pallet's going to slide off, and then while we're turning, you're going to run off. Was that your experience, or were they under that kind of fire at that time?
No, fortunately for me, they weren't yet. That would be about another 6 weeks. I just sauntered off into the mud, and, you know, I was wandering up the company street in my stateside uniform, you know, and looking very, very new, very green, and slopping through the mud. But, I got situated, and then the NBA didn't attack us until January 20th. But on January 12th, I was sent TAD to Kaysan Village, to the district headquarters down there. There was manned by a handful of Marines, about 28 Marines in the village, four Army Special Forces. And we had about 100 indigenous troops, mostly Montagnards, so right. Kind of primitive people, local people, very, very decent people like Americans. And then on January 20th, I was supposed to come back a week later, but the Jeep never came. And I knew that things weren't looking too good. And then on the morning of January 21st, we were overrun by a battalion, and they didn't get through the wire because they had prearranged artillery fire and caught them out in the open. And there's more to the story. I won't get into it, but I thought the NBA kept actually meticulous records. It's just that they weren't translated until 25 years later. And I found out there was some very absurd reasons why they were unable to take a mere platoon of Americans with a battalion. But
well, tell us what you can't tease us like this and leave us hanging.
Oh, sorry.
Why did they not?
Well, this is one of the things in my. I'm currently writing a fourth book, and it deals with Kaysan, and it just happens to, because I got good at research, I guess you could say, and found out where to look. But what happened was. They got lost in their night march, and they were a reinforced battalion. They had a sapper team, they had a recordist rifle team, they had mortar team. They were ready to just come through our wire. And quite frankly, we were in a little village. We had barbed wire set up around an old French colonial building that had been the district headquarters since they were there. And you know, it wasn't much. And I was always amazed that we survived. But it turns out, I found out 40 years later that. They got lost. They got separated. They arrived late. The NVA liked to attack in the middle of the night.
Right.
They arrived just at sun up. they decided to do it anyway, and they walked into this prearranged artillery fire we had, and they lost their whole command group. They ended up with a lieutenant, a political officer, who, you know, is not really a grunt or infantry trade, commanding, and he had a broken arm. And anyway, they actually, it surprised me as I was getting into NVA records, how, you know, relatively honest they were about their body counts of their own people. The attack on the village turned out to be the single worst loss of any single day battle they had at Khaesan. They lost 154 dead and nearly 400 more wounded. They were just absolutely decimated by it. But it had to do with bad luck, bungling, and some pretty good artillery fire from our base.
We love that artillery fire. They don't play much as grunts. I'll tell you this: they don't play often enough. But when they do, it's, most of the time they do quality work. Wow. So when you think about that, if whoever's navigating navigates well and they don't get, I'd be curious to have a microphone inside your head as you're reading, doing this research, right? And you discover this. So if they do things well that night, you probably get killed that night.
Oh, absolutely. There's no doubt in my mind. It was 30 meters from my comm bunker outside the district headquarters to the wire. And again, it was only a couple of rows of concertina stacked. And, you know, they could have, one zapper could have blown that in a few seconds. So, I don't think their engineer showed up is what happened. But yeah, I'm very, very lucky. And Mac, you're absolutely right. I was every time I saw howitzer around Khaesan, I was kissing the barrel of it if it wasn't too hot because they saved my life. Yeah.
Interesting. Talk to us about what I want to do, Mike, is I want to talk about not only your Khaesan experience a little bit. I want to talk about how you get into writing and then the rest of your career. So Khaesan happens. When did you get out of the Marine Corps?
Got out of the Marine Corps in February of 70. And I got an early out. Believe it or not, they were downsizing already than the Marine Corps because, you know, they had pulled out of Vietnam a few months after that in early 71. And, so they were downsizing radio operators, and I was out about 3 months before my enlistment.
Okay. And so after that, what do you do?
After that, I went to, you know, I came back to, I had gone to high school in Berkeley, and I grew up in North Oakland, and the year 1978 was like going through a time warp. When I left, there was mild resistance to the Vietnam War. And
1968, you said 78, but you meant 68, right?
Oh, no, I'm so sorry. Yeah, absolutely. 68, thank you.
Well,
I left.
Can I pause you for a second? You know, the PBS documentary, you know, I think finished last night at the end of 66, maybe into 67. And what you're watching, though, is this collision that's about to take place inside of the United States, the collision that's going to take place in Vietnam with the Tet Offensive. And, you know, 1968, I was thinking this morning, do you think the nation's ever had a more traumatic year than 1968?
Not since the American Civil War, no.
Yeah,
it was unbelievable.
The assassination of Martin Luther King, the assassination of Robert Kennedy, you have Tet going on, you have the protests in Berkeley and around the country. I think the riots take place the following year around the country. You have the Democratic National Convention that we watch on TV and the craziness surrounding that. You know, it's like the world has become unhinged. It's a little bit like what I feel right now. But watching it last night, I thought this is all in preparation for one of the most traumatic years in the nation's history, and that is 1968. So absolutely. I can remember. I grew up not far from where Mike lived, less than 70 miles from where Mike lived in Sacramento. I'm probably about 10 years younger. And I remember seeing the covers of Life magazine, the huge protest in Berkeley, right? And the riots that they had there. And I remember distinctly, I think his name is Mario Savio, something like that. But he was a student protester at Berkeley, and I remember him being on the cover, something burning, and somebody flipping the bird to the camera through the fire of this. A picture like that that was on the cover of Life magazine. And here's, I'm an Irish Catholic kid in California going to St. Charles Borromeo. 1968, I would have been 11. So what does that make me in fourth grade or fifth grade? Some craziness like that. And you're watching this, right? And then going home and watching Leave It to Beaver and Dobie Gillis on TV and wondering, right? And Gunsmoke, wondering what in God's name is going on the planet. So talk about, yeah, unhinged, changed a little bit from when you left in 68. What was it like to go back?
Oh, it was, and you're dead on. You know, history, you know, we always like to compartmentalize history a little bit and say, well, it was this year or this person that made the difference. But 1968 was one of those, was really one of those, you know, uncompartmentalized. It was where everything came to a head. And again, leaving in 67, you know, I had friends. And when I got back in December of 68, right before Christmas, it was just like a different world. You know, and let me give you an idea how much shock it was. Not only were, you know, and again, I hung out. My neighborhood was in North Oakland and Berkeley. And, you know, there was pictures of Mao and Ho Chi Minh and Che Guevara hanging from every window around the campus. I exaggerate, but from many. And a lot of national liberation flags, you know, a lot of VC flags. And someone had, at that time, the mailboxes in the Bay Area, and you might remember the Sacramento, were painted blue on top and red on the bottom, you know. And people went around pasting gold stars right at the conjunction of the two colors, so it looked like VC flags. And when I got home, every time I'd drive around in my dad's station wagon, every time I'd make a turn to go somewhere, there was a VC flag plastered on the side of the mailboxes, and it was real culture shock.
So did you drive over the mailbox? That's what I'm waiting for. And so? My dad never did figure it out why those dents were in the front of the station wagon. The Ford Country Squire with wood paneling on the side.
Speaking of your dad, you know, I did a little homework, and he was the manager of the Oakland A's when I got back in the late 60s and early 70s. I remember that.
Is that crazy? No, I mean, so it's like, you know, we would have been separated on occasion by probably a mile, maybe. Maybe if, I don't know if you went to any of the baseball games, probably there at the same time. But, no.
Oh, yeah.
That's how I spent my summer. And I was telling Mike, one of the things I vividly remember from the Oakland A's yearbook that, you know, when you went to the stadium, you could buy a scorecard to keep score that day, and then you could buy a yearbook that had the biographies of the players and all their past statistics, because there was no internet. There wasn't even a thought of the internet at that time. And in the back, it had pictures, and it had family pictures, and it also had pictures of the players doing things. And there was a couple pages devoted to the players of the Oakland A's going to the Naval Hospital in Alameda, and sitting and talking with guys that had been wounded in Vietnam. And I've never forgotten, and Mike and I were talking about that yesterday, but yeah, small world kind of stuff. How do you go from Quezon, which even by Vietnam standards is a bit extreme, and then come home to that and not not get in fistfights all the time because you're so pissed?
Yeah, that happened. You know, I mean, I was mad at myself for kind of harboring memories that I believed were true. And so, you know, I took responsibility at first, but no, you're right. And you know, it was compounded by the fact, and again, this is the subject of my last book, The Long Goodbye. It was compounded by the fact that my friend Tom Mahoney, who I'd gone into the Marine Corps with, my high school buddy, was killed on the last day that it was abandoned, and his body was not recovered. His Marine buddies tried to recover it from under an ambush. So I had to face his mom and his sister right before Christmas when I got home, which was, as you can imagine, was indescribably difficult. Right. Tom's dad, Thomas Patrick Mahoney II, had been killed during the Korean War, and Tom was eventually, his body still hasn't been recovered, but we're working hard on that right now. But his epitaph is engraved on the back of his dad's tombstone, in the National Cemetery in San Francisco. So with all this history of already losing one generation of Mahoney men to war, you can imagine, everything was coming down on me, not only the society that I'd come back to, but the survivor's guilt of dealing with his family.
And so, did you spend a lot of time drinking? Did you do drugs? Did you go get an education?
No, I was self-medicating a lot, and I went to, and to answer your question, how did I cope with it? I left. Not too far. I went up to your territory. I went to Sacramento. A buddy of mine, Steve Orr, who'd been in my platoon at the Quezon, we'd remained friends, which was kind of unusual for Vietnam vets, and he was from Sacramento, and so I moved up there. We got an apartment together. I went to American River College and then ended up graduating from Cal State Sacramento. About the time you were probably in high school, I think, but our paths may have even crossed. You never know. But, yeah, and so that's how I dealt with it. And you know what? One of the saving things was, and it seems like a small thing, is Steve and I had shared exactly the same experiences. We were together in the comp platoon in regimental comm with 26 Marines. And so I was saved in a way by that because I could retreat to someone and talk to them who had exactly the same experience as I did. And I don't think many vets were fortunate enough to experience that.
You know, what's interesting is because of social media, we can do that today. Every day I talk to five guys, and we have our own little chat. It's not a chat, but we do this group text. And, you know, all of a sudden you'll see you got a text message and you'll look and you'll read, CC Sabathia is a fat fuck. So now we have to have a discussion about CC Sabathia, who's a pitcher for the Yankees, about his weight, right? He's from Vallejo too. So he's part of the California crew. But can you describe how important that was? That is because, you know, most guys don't find their peers till they walk into a VFW or a Legion or a vet center, and all of a sudden they reconnect with guys who have their experience. And so, Mike, I mean, I would tell you that your experience for a Vietnam guy is very atypical in terms of you have somebody there who when you can go to and talk to and doesn't look at you like you're crazy, right? You're not afraid that they're going to judge you because they know. That's pretty amazing. You're obviously a fortunate guy.
Yeah, and I was. And we all suffered from PTSD, although at the time we got back, that term hadn't even been coined. And and most Marines, most Army guys that had been in combat, just didn't know how to deal with it and didn't know there was a problem. And quite frankly, we believed for a decade until it became acceptable to get treatment that if you went and got treatment, you were not hacking it. You were not a good Marine. You weren't doing what your dad's generation.
Well, and I was going to say,
got over it.
Yeah, the burden of the World War II generation is, what do you need to go down there for? Right? Just come back.
Yep.
and get back to work. And I mean, because they didn't talk about their demons. And I remember talking to Marines in my first deployment to Iraq, and then, you know, you find out that somebody's having nightmares, somebody can't sleep, blah, 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 blah. Hey, come here, I want to talk to you. You know, and maybe a corporal sergeant, you know, and a major talking to a corporal sergeant. They're like, what's up, sir? I hear you can't sleep. I hear you're having nightmares. And they said, how did you hear about that? Like, I pay attention. And so you start talking to them, and is that true? And they look at you, and they say, yeah. And you can tell by the look on their face, they think they're fucked up or they don't know. And, you know, is this happening to me now? And I would say, you think you're fucked up, don't you? And they'd look at you and they'd say, I don't know. And I would say always, well, you are fucked up. And they would laugh, right? And they would say, I'd say, but you're fucked up like just about everybody else in here. Okay. And I said, and then I would ask them, do you ever see, you know, do you ever watch the History Channel? Oh, yes, sir. I love that stuff. I said, well, those fucking pussies from World War II are still crying about that shit, and that's 70 years ago. So Do you think you're going to get away from it? But when you were going through this, there was no History Channel. They didn't cry in public about it, right? They marched in the parade. They got drunk at the VFW and hung out together. And there was no public airing of the underpinnings of the experience.
Yeah, you're right. And in fact, you know, for those of us coming back to the late 60s, you know, a lot of VFWs, American Legion halls, they didn't want Vietnam vets there because they felt that we had lost the first war in American history, you know, notwithstanding Korea and a few places. But we felt that. It's not that we, I guess, needed validation from our, well, we, of course we did. We wanted validation from our public generation, but we didn't get that either. And
I heard that for the first time a few months ago, and I was like, come on, man, make it stop. So in addition to everything else, the Vietnam veterans are shitting on you, too. I mean, the World War II veterans are new.
Oh, yeah.
And I think it was Bob Nielsen told me. He said, yeah. Like, what, you jackasses can't whip those little, you know, whatever, those little rice-burning punks? What's wrong with you? We took on the Germans and whacked them like you can't take care of them. And I said, come on, man, you're making that shit up. And he said, I wish I was. So when does it stop for you guys? What the hell?
Yeah, it was tough, and that eventually went away. But you know, that again, you know, when you feel there's a stigma like that, you know, then you internalize it, and it did go away. It didn't go away. It just went away externally. And you know, I think Carl Malanti's on the documentary the other night said something that really touched home. He said, you know, he had a social. He and his wife had a couple. They socialized with for 4 years before he knew that the guy had been in the Marine Corps and in Vietnam at the same time that Malanti's had. And you know, that's
No, hold on. He didn't say four. It was 12 years.
12. I'm sorry. Very good. Yeah, thanks.
No, he's been on here a number of times. And one of the things, he's a funny guy. He tells this really funny story. As a Rhodes Scholar, he'd been with his company for a few weeks, and he said, and I think I'd acquitted myself well, and the Marines were kind of comfortable, and he said, one of my 19-year-old Lance Corporal squad leaders were cleaning weapons, walks up to me and says, hey, sir, is it true that you're a Rhodes Scholar and that you went to Yale? And Marlana says, I looked at him, and I said, yeah, it's true. And he looked at me and he said, you got to be the dumbest fucking Rhodes Scholar on the planet. And, you know, you have this picture of them sitting around, right, rifles disassembled, cleaning them. And he said, the Marines actually, he said, they fell out laughing. And because they didn't believe that I was, you know, that I could be with them with my education. And he said, I just looked at him and said, you could probably make the case that that's a fact. But he said he never associated his anger, his explosive anger, with his combat experiences until wife number two told him he should probably go down and talk to an occupational therapy specialist about it. And the first question, you know, after he says, I've got anger issues, the guy looks at him and says, were you in Vietnam? And he said, I started crying. And so Marlana's an interesting guy. I thought it was really interesting the other night when he was talking about McNamara, and what he can't forgive is that he knew it wasn't going to work in 65 and come to that conclusion, and that he didn't act on it, and that there was a lot of death that happened that didn't have to if he would have done the right thing. And that when he's talking about it right at the end, you can see his mouth begin to quiver, right? These are not weak men, right? And that still, after all these years, the emotion of the experience, the emotion of, I think, the sense of betrayal that they felt by people very highly placed in government who didn't believe in the cause but didn't have the moral courage to stand up and say it. And it even hit me again last night. At the start of 1966, there had been 2,800 Americans killed in Vietnam. That's a long way from 58,000 in 1966. So it tells you,
yeah.
Right? It tells you a little bit about 67, 68, 69, and 70. I mean, holy shit numbers coming out of Vietnam in terms of guys that are going to be killed. But how do you get into, so how do you, professionally, how do you migrate to going to work in Nevada for the legislature?
Before I, let me comment on one thing you said, because I think it's, you're spot on. When he was talking about Johnson, talking about McNamara and Johnson, you know, one of the things that struck me, and I've done a lot of research on the Vietnam War. I use that, I think, writing my books and doing just extensive research of records on both sides of the war to kind of work my way out of this. But he is dead on when he said, you know, it's one thing to have made, you know, an incorrect political decision, as they may have done early in the war, mm-hmm. for the right reason. But it's another thing to know it's wrong and cover it up. And, you know, to hear Johnson on that tape, I'd read a lot of this, but reading's one thing, but to hear his voice on that tape as early as 65 and 66 saying, we can't win. George Herring, who wrote, Dr. George Herring, who wrote America's Longest War, one of the better treatments of the Vietnam War, said that Lyndon Johnson had invested so much of his own prestige in the war by then that he couldn't back out. And that's a horrendous thing to hear and read, but to hear it in his own voice, I was shaken the other night after I heard that. It was as if I hadn't heard it before. But to get on with what you were saying, you wonder
how
I...
So when you hear that now, Mike, can you go to sleep after you hear that? Are you up for a fair amount of hours after you see that?
Yeah, when you get that feeling, you've been in combat, you get that feeling when it starts coming back to you a little bit that, you know, you're shaken. You're a little bit shaken to the core, you know, and that was one of those moments where I wish I hadn't heard that tape. But even though I'd already knew that as a fact. In fact, you know, Johnson, before the siege of Quezon had ended, putting things in perspective, the Tet had finally wound down a little bit. There was another one that started in May of 68, but it wound down. And March 30th, while the siege of Quezon was still underway and I was still there, Johnson said he would not run again, and he stopped the bombing of North Vietnam below the 20th parallel, which was really the supply area. And he asked to start negotiations with the North Vietnamese to end the war all at once. And, you know, two thoughts occurred to me knowing that. Number one, okay, he's a lame duck president. Why doesn't he suck it up and do what's right now? He's not going to lose anything except perhaps the Democratic Party not winning in November. But the other thing was that at that very moment, those of us at Quezon, even though we're only 19, 20-year-olds, we realized that from now on, we were going to win. We were going to be pawns in a game of negotiation like it happened at the end of the Korean War and Pork Chop Hill and all that. And that was a game changer for all of us in Vietnam.
What in terms of?
Well, in terms of the fact that we didn't, you know, the old saying is, who wants to be the last guy to die in a lost cause? And that was the mentality we had. Do you want to be the last guy to die before they sign this thing in Paris? Just buying time for a signature. You know, it changed it. It changed the way we felt about the war, at least me and people around me.
My guest is Mike Archer. And he's now retired, retired working for the Nevada legislature, and he's written how many books? Four, Mike?
I'm on my fourth. I've written two about Vietnam, about Quezon. One is called A Patch of Ground, Quezon Remembered, and my most recent in May is The Long Goodbye, Quezon Revisited.
Okay, and people that are listening, that are interested, they can find those books. How do you have a website? Yes.
Yeah, I have a website, but they're also, you know, being sold, distributed nationally at independent bookstores and on Amazon, and you can buy it through Hellgate Press, my publisher. In the meantime, between the two books, I wrote a political history of Nevada about a senator that I worked for at the legislature.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to get you his thoughts, his further thoughts on Ken Burns' series. And also, I mean, I'm sure you look at it from a couple of different lenses. One is as a writer and a storyteller, I mean, how do you, even to say that, let's just say he has 15 to 20 hours, how do you narrow Vietnam down to treat it well in 15 to 20 hours, given the scope of everything that is Vietnam? I mean, it's even with that kind of time, it's a daunting task as you begin to pie it up as a storyteller. And so I want to get your thoughts on that. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. More of All Marine Radio coming up next on a Thursday right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nielsen. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it. This hour of All Marine Radio is brought to you by our friends at Battle Mug, home of the world-famous Battle Mug. Starts as 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at BattleMug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out, BattleMug.com.
I'm an individual member. I joined the Global South Foundation because I believe in what it can do, and I also wanted to stay tied to the community that I was part of.
The benefits for individual members of the Global South Foundation are two things. One is networking, keeping in touch with the community, developing new relationships at any stage of your career. And secondly, it helps people stay abreast and up to date on the latest issues that the SOF community should be aware of.
The Global South Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marine.
MilitaryByOwner.com is an excellent resource for any military family moving to a new area. We found a ton of homes to choose from and purchased a house 8 days later. This was the only site I used. Thanks, Military by Owner.
Are you PCSing? Do you need to find a home near a military base quickly? With over 45,000 listings and 15 years of experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base, MilitaryByOwner.com can help. Military by Owner. Proven and dependable.
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. Moms, dads, neighbors, teachers, friends. These are the people who are always there to listen when we need to talk. Though their actions may not always be monumental, they are always felt. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone. One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit VeteransCrisisLine.net for free 24/7 confidential support or call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Eight 13 on a Thursday. Mike McNamara with you, joined by a fellow Northern Californian and compadre from the Oakland area, Mike Archer. And Mike is a veteran of Quezon. And Mike, honestly, there's so much to talk about with you. It's hard to limit. I want to go back to Quezon, but before we do that, I want to talk about Ken Burns. I want to talk about the significance of his work to the community of Vietnam veterans. There's no small amount of anxiety about it, first of all, the lead up to it. What would it be? Would it be just another knife in the back that Vietnam veterans have received over the course of years in terms of the way they're treated, the way their war was treated, the narrative of the war? Would it be told completely? Would it be fair? Would it be balanced? So I started thinking about this last week, and then I started getting emails forwarded to me that Vietnam veterans had written. So I'm curious, you're a storyteller. Have you watched all four episodes so far? And if you have, what are your thoughts relative to it in terms of how he's cut it down to treat it effectively in the amount of time that he has? And is it a fair, balanced representation of Vietnam? So your thoughts.
Yeah, I agree with you about the anxiety. I've been getting that on my networks too, social media networks and emails leading up to this. And the same thing you were hearing. Oh, well, they're not going to do us. They're not going to do right by us and so forth. I have watched the four. It hasn't gotten to my time in the war and that of my friends, so I don't know how that'll be treated. But, you know, so far I think it's surprisingly balanced. I mean, think what, you know, going back to the, you know, when the problem occurred during the 50s and earlier, I mean, there's so many different players in this geopolitical drama, you know, not Chinese, Soviets, Americans. So many other things going on, like the Cuban Missile Crisis, which was terrifying to me. I was 14. I remember every night thinking that would be it, that we were going to be incinerated in a nuclear war, and there was no escaping from it. And very traumatic for people. You may even remember that. I don't know how young you were then. But to sum all that up in 1 hour, to get on with this long, long war, I thought he did a fantastic job. I like, having gone back to Vietnam and met many of my former, or several of my former adversaries and many people who survived the war, on both sides, I thought he did this Novick did an excellent job, bringing them into it. And, you know, there's a lot of propaganda on both sides during the war, a lot of rumor, a lot of, demonizing of the enemy and so forth. And I'm glad to see that both sides' commentaries got over that and talked about the realities of it. The one thing I haven't seen yet is, you know, the Vietnam, the GM regime and the subsequent generals, they were for the most part pretty corrupt. And I think that reflected poorly on the Arvins. And I've met a couple of Arvins in Saigon in 2007, former Arvins who spent up to 8 years in re-education camps and were brutalized and are now considered non-persons in that society because they fought against the North. I think they're getting a little bit of a short shrift. They were very dedicated guys, many of them. People that have read about these, after the Americans left the fighting at the Citadel and Quang Tri, one of the bloodiest battles of the war entirely, the Arvin against the North Vietnamese, you know, be hard pressed to say these guys weren't pretty dedicated to defending their country. So, I'd like to have seen a little more, you know, objectivity in that area.
How do you think? One of the things that I got an email about last night was, or early this morning was, after somebody watched it, was, do you think Robert McNamara is being Do you think Robert McNamara is being treated with kid gloves? He is he is Don Rumsfeld to me. There's incredible parallels between Vietnam and Iraq, and it's at times it's eerie. Did you read H.R. McMaster's book, Dereliction of Duty?
Yes.
So my question is, that's a deep rabbit hole to go down relative to storytelling. And I don't know that he has the time or if it fits in the broader picture that he tries to paint of Vietnam. But McNamara is a central figure to it. And so far he's being painted as in a pretty humane way relative to the decisions he made. I'm just curious your thoughts.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. I try to keep my books, as uninflammatory as possible, given the nature of it. But in my book, The Long Goodbye, I couldn't resist treating this subject even before I saw the Burns thing. And yes, he is being treated with kid gloves here. They're trying to make him out, and he was a bean counter, he was a statistic guy, and I understand that. And coincidentally, he grew up in Oakland and went to Cal Berkeley. He grew up about a three-quarters of a mile from my friend Tom Mahoney. And he died, again, I love the absurdity, the irony of things. He died on July 6th, exactly 47 years after my friend did on July 6th. He wrote a book later in retrospect, McNamara did, and there was also a documentary film that came out about him. And, you could read, and this is in the 90s, Grant, you could read his displeasure at being the only one alive to have to take the brunt of this, when in fact he was at the forefront of it. And he was a yes man in all those meetings. And I agree with you about Rumsfeld. He even wore, when you said eerie, they even wore the same style of eyeglasses, for God's sake. It was too creepy. But.
And so arrogant, to the point of, and our experience was being in Iraq, knowing you don't have enough guys, watching Rumsfeld be an arrogant prick, telling the American media that they have everybody that they've asked for, they have everybody they need, and you're over there playing whack-a-mole and going, you got to be shitting me.
Yeah.
The interesting general impressions of the series so far, and would you recommend it to other Vietnam veterans to watch?
Yeah, if I could touch on one other thing.
Sure.
About McNamara, you were right, Mac. By the way, you're not related to him, are you?
No.
Okay.
My dad's responsible for Game 6 of the 1986 World Series when the ball went through Bill Buckner's leg. Okay.
I would have left Buckner in just in case they went into extra innings on that. But anyway,
it was awful.
What was I going to say now? He was. You're right. He espoused what Clemenceau said at the end of World War I, that war is too serious a matter to be left to the generals, which, of course, was crazy. Why should war be left to the president of General Motors Corporation? But General Maxwell Taylor, who came after him, who was supposed to have been more military, more savvy, was also a real Machiavellian kind of guy. If you read about him, he continued to drive a wedge between Joint Chiefs and the President, LBJ. It was just a very ugly thing to have to face after dealing with that war.
But Burns has largely stayed out of it. So I'm curious, do you think balance is a word that Bob Nielsen, a guy who I've had on who's a Vietnam veteran, he said, overall, I think it's a balanced representation of Vietnam. And I would say, with the exception of McNamara's very, very humane treatment, I would agree with that. I'd be curious, your thoughts. Do you believe it's balanced, or are there certain parts of your Vietnam veteranness that tingle at certain things?
Once again, you know, I think the Arvins, you know, the Arvins had a lot more staying power than they're led to believe after Opdok and those battles. But, you know, except for that and the McNamara thing, and I guess McNamara is going to be leaving soon because he also bugged out in February of 68, after giving Johnson a letter of resignation the previous November, stating that he didn't think the war was winnable. But yeah, I think it's very balanced. And, you know, to see veterans crying always chokes me up too.
What a piece of shit. You know, it's not winnable. Hey, you got us there, motherfucker. Right?
Yeah.
You know, and here's my resignation. What, do you quit? It got too difficult? You got us in here. You can't, you know, it reminds me of one of the things that I heard Jay Vargas say, I'm a second lieutenant. I think I'm in Burger King or Wendy's main side with my second lieutenant buddy. He might have been a first lieutenant at the time, Pete Flood from Schenectady, New York. So we're standing in line and he looks at me and goes, do you know who that is? And I said, no. And he's staring at this lieutenant colonel. He said, that's Jay Vargas. I said, who's Jay Vargas? He said, won the Medal of Honor in Vietnam. And he said, we need to go talk to him. And I said, no, we're not going to bother him at lunch. So so we get our lunch. Vargas is sitting at the table. He's a lieutenant colonel, main side of Camp Pendleton. So by himself, so nobody else is sitting around him. So we walk up and we say, Pete says, sir, do you mind if we join you? And he looks up and he says, I'm not talking about it. And and I look at him and I said, I told you. And he says, sit down, lieutenants. And so Pete starts asking him about, you know, would you mind talking? He said, well, let me just give you the bottom line. I'm the one that fucked it up, okay? I was the company commander. Or, you know, I put him in that position. What was I just going to do, leave? They were my guys. And when I hear that about McNamara, he wasn't man enough to stay and to continue to do, you know, what he could to mitigate what he had done. It's unseemly to me. I don't know. It offends me. It offends the Jay Vargas in me.
Yeah.
So anyway,
I love to hear that from a company level officer, grunt officer like
right.
That.
Well, you ask guys who do heroic things, and you say, "What were you doing?" And they give you this very mundane answer, right? What were you doing? Like, well, they were my friends. Like, what was I going to do? Leave them? I wasn't leaving them. Like, oh, I thought it was like a lot more complicated than that. And
one thing popped into my mind when you said that, you know, about McNamara, the former chief of station in Saigon for the CIA, his name was Pierre Silva. After McNamara's book came out, in retrospect, kind of, you know, making, I guess, an apology, but mostly excuses for what happened, De Silva came out and blasted him and said, and I'm quoting this, said, McNamara's problem was that he was arrogant and he was dumb, end quote. So just to give you an idea of how he was felt at the highest levels of the intelligence community at the time.
My guest is Mike Archer. He's a veteran of the Marine Corps. He's a veteran of the Battle of Khe Sanh. He was a communicator there. I was put in touch with him by Ken Rogers, who, if you listen to the program, people know Ken Rogers. And so we're talking about the PBS documentary, The Vietnam War, made by Ken Burns. Mike is an author, so he's a storyteller, so a unique perspective, as well as somebody who's published two books on Vietnam and about Khe Sanh. And then the next one you're writing is about what, Mike?
If I could just interject one thing, I'd like to say for those that of your listeners who have not seen Ken Burns' documentary, Ken's documentary Bravo, Roger, it's fantastic, it's a real glimpse into what the horror of Khe Sanh, the siege of Khe Sanh.
Yeah, well, let me just tell you. So he sends me a copy, and he says, make sure you watch it on a good sound system with a good sound system and turn it up. 20 minutes into the documentary, right, the dog's under the bed. I'm starting to get pissed because there's so many explosions. And it slowly sinks into you that these guys went through this for 77 days. Like, how is anybody sane after that? Now, Mike, were you there for the whole event?
Oh, yeah. I was there from a month before it began till about 2 weeks after it ended.
Okay, so how are you even close to being right in the head?
You know, it's funny. As I mentioned in the long goodbye, you know, when they flew us out of there to Quang Tri, I left on April 18th. On the flight there, I remember thinking, maybe I'm crazy and I just don't know it, because I thought the same thing. How could I not be? You know, and everybody around me is crazy. And, you know, the thing that you didn't want to dwell on too much during an artillery pounding like that for, you know, 10 weeks is that there was no bunker at Quezon that was safe from a 130 or 155 millimeter Soviet round that they were throwing in at us. And even 120 millimeter mortar is a very nasty weapon. So you had to get out of your head that day and night, anywhere on the base, you could die in that second. You know, there, and Kantian, another bad place in along the DMZ, it was the same way. There was no structures that you could survive. And so it's a good question, Mac. I don't know how we push that out of our minds all the time, but we seem to.
Wow. Let me tell you, because by the end of watching Bravo, with everything that they endured from the Ghost Patrol to the pounding, just to the daily casualties, let alone the first dramatic days of it, you'll watch it with your jaw on the floor. So by all means, if you do a search, Bravo, Common Men, Uncommon Valor, Ken Rogers, if you search that, you'll find it. I would tell you, absolutely watch it. It's an
incredible. Absolutely. And the production values are unparalleled. You know, they're as good as anything you're going to get anywhere else.
It's amazing. It's amazing. Things you don't know about Quezon, and then how it never leaves. You know, you'll be done dealing with this when they close the casket on your ass. You know, so just so everybody knows, you're not getting away from it. You're not getting over it. You know, you'll hopefully learn to coexist with it. And one of the most vivid parts of it is, I can't remember the guy's name, but he talks about going after the Ghost Patrol, I don't know how long, but going back and clearing trenches and finding NVA soldiers in those trenches. And he, when you watch him, his eyes light up, and he's so animated, and you can tell he's back, he's there. As he's talking to you, he's describing this vivid scene about he raised his weapon and he turned and this happened and that happened. And he's describing it in high definition in this very rapid dialogue that he's having. It's really uncanny to watch it. It's so vivid and, you know, it's an insight in how people, you know, deal with it. And again, making this almost 50 years after the event. Pretty.
Oh, yeah. You know, Bravo was allowed to, as you know, at the end of March, to what they called the payback. They went out there to get their bodies. They had bayonets fixed, and it was. I was in the trench line watching that day, and it was unbelievable. I'm glad I didn't experience it, because they took Captain Pipes and many of them. They took a lot of casualties on that too.
They, but that was the payback, and you know, it's so different. One of the things that, as you talk to different guys, so different. I mean, now we have drones, and you know, we have all kinds of stuff to find out what's in front of us. It's still not perfect, but you know, you can take a look. I mean, what do you guys know? What the intel guys are telling you? What do they know? You know, what somebody told them? You know, so it's just you're out there essentially groping to find the bad guys who've infiltrated in big numbers around Quezon, but you guys don't know it yet. And so it's pretty amazing. I've got an email for you. Hey, Mac. First of all, extremely interesting guest this morning. Thanks to Ken Rogers for making this happen. Always interested. I'm curious about, is there any part of the series that that your guest is more interested than any other time? I imagine your time there and how they represent Quezon would probably be the most interesting. But, Mike, is there anything that, you found most interesting in the series so far?
You know, I'd done so much research on the war for the books, and, you know, my books are heavily referenced. But, you know, again, touching on hearing the voices of McNamara and Johnson were chilling to me, you know, even though I knew that they'd given up on the winning the war long before I ever arrived there. And, of course, you know, what's interesting to me, it's a good question, is always hearing from the other side, you know, just we always wondered what was running through their mind. You know, we tended to dehumanize them, think of them as, you know, communist Marxist automatons that would march into, you know, but they weren't quite that. And I'm actually, you're not going to believe this, but I'm actually emailed pen pal with one of the people that killed my friend, Nguyen Tien Tham, who lives in Hanoi. You know, I don't consider him a friend. When I interviewed him, when I talked to him, he was very respectful, and you know, he'd actually dragged my friend's body. Another guy shot him, and he'd actually dragged Tom into a kill zone for the ambush. You know, it's a real eye opener, and I think for people watching, to have the experience that I did meeting these guys, at least vicariously through the documentary, is a real eye opener and really important.
You know, that is the most. Having been, you know, doing interviews like this throughout the week, that those voices of, you know, whether it be the Viet Cong or the NVA, that perspective is what I think most Marines that I've talked to have found most riveting. Their how they lived, how they fought, what they thought has been the most interesting. What I find interesting, though, is, you know, the war's been over for 50 years. Or coming up on it, and we've been in a bit of a digital age for a while. Yet we really, in any great number, have not seen these kind of interviews. And I kind of puzzled, like, well, this could have been done a while ago, but we've never seen it. Interesting.
Yeah, you know, one of the problems, I think, unlike other wars, you know, like you know, we all, you know, there was reunions, as you mentioned yesterday. We're talking between American soldiers and British soldiers and Germans and American soldiers and Japanese, and that didn't take all that long for those people to get together and understand the bonds that they shared, even though they were enemies, as you know, as survivors of the terrible war. But you know, with Vietnam, you have to remember that we punished Vietnam economically for winning the war, and we cut all communication with them and no economic aid, and it wasn't for, you know, 18 years or 19 years before we opened up diplomatic channels again, even though many of the QVETs, the people that the boat people and stuff were living here, and there was connections with the country then. So I think, if you want my opinion, it was that. And also another thing that I found very frustrating at first when I started my research 10 years ago that's improved is, although the NVA, the North Vietnamese Army, kept, you know, impeccable records, surprising records. Let me give you a quick example. When my friend was shot, the platoon leader, Mr. Luong, who shot him twice in the heart from about 40 feet out, later filed a report and said his face was red and he had the eyes of a mean animal, end quote. I mean, they wrote very graphic reports in time. I mean, this wasn't memoir.
Right.
So, you know, I think that their records stayed in boxes, largely because they didn't have, they weren't digitalized for a long time, and largely because, you know, you have to remember that, you know, the communist North was a very totalitarian state, and the party didn't want honest observation of what had happened during the war. They wanted to sweep the war, even though they lost a million troops, they wanted to sweep the war under the rug, and it wasn't until the 1990s when one of the guests on that show, Bao Ninh, wrote The Sorrow of War and got the vets stirred up to find out what had happened to those their comrades.
It's interesting. Probably within the last 3 months, I ran across interviews done with survivors of Iwo Jima. And I bumped into him by accident, and you've never heard that perspective. And I played him here, and the interviews are unbelievable. How they lived, how they died, ultimately, the last guys that were living, they pumped salt water into the caves that they were in, and then they dumped, I believe, diesel fuel on top of the salt water, and then they lit the diesel fuel on fire. And you're hearing this narrative, but I mean, it's just all riveting because we've never heard it. Never heard it. And the Japanese survivors of Iwo Jima, they were dishonored, right? They survived, were taken captive, didn't die there. And so they've gone home and they've never said a word. And to see, to hear the things they say, what they lived through, and then not to be able to go home and to talk to people about it. Because we don't do that. Pretty amazing the stories that they tell. And this along kind of similar lines as you're talking about, you know, paper records, totalitarian state, not really into this. We're just going to celebrate the victory. I guess that's a good enough. That's the best explanation I've heard in terms of we've never really heard this and why it's the most compelling part. For a lot of guys, it's the most compelling part. I've got another email for you. Mac, I have a caisson question for Mike. What do people misunderstand about caisson? He's had a lifetime to reflect on his experience there. What do most people miss about caisson? Mike?
That's a really good question and very topical because this is kind of the main subject of my current book, which should be out hopefully next year, early next year. It's going to be a very short book, about 100 pages, but well documented. The most misunderstood thing, the mystery they say of caisson is, did the NVA want to take the base, want to replicate their dramatic victory at Dien Bien Phu in 1954 that has drove the French out of the country? And the pictures of the French, 16,000 French captives being marched away and this and that, was very compelling, especially, for the Western world because it's the first time a guerrilla army had defeated a Western industrialized state. Question remains, and I'm addressing it with the current records as I can find, or was it a diversion to tie up a lot of American and Arvin troops up in the mountains where they couldn't assist in repelling the Tet Offensive in the city throughout the rest of the country, and probably more importantly, the air resources. You know, caisson required an enormous amount of helicopter and bombers. I mean, we had bombers. I was on the tactical air control party. And we had bombers on station 24/7 because we had radar control bombing there at the base. And I was a 19-year-old radio operator. We had so many targets that the target intelligence officer, Captain Begg, who is the subject of my book, by the way, he would give us coordinates and have us, design bombing runs and call in, the bombers because some of these F-4s from Da Nang only had 12 minutes on station, fuel-wise. But, anyway, so that's the question. Was it a diversion? And all, I mean, it was a serious matter, don't get me wrong, but, and my, what I'm hearing from the North Vietnamese, their documents and from experiencing it, was that they very much wanted to take that base. And, I describe a series of just, like I mentioned about Caisson Village, about them becoming lost. This was an issue at every one of the outposts that they were trying to roll up, a la Dien Bien Phu, to take the base. They bungled. They had bad luck. Their communications, I document this in great detail. Their communication security was abysmal. I mean, they didn't know encryption or anything like that. So they were giving and we had people at the base translating their radio, transmissions and, they were just giving it all away. So anyway, that to answer your listener, I think that's the biggest issue, and I think I hope I help resolve it a little bit come January or February next year.
does it need to be an either or proposition? Could it be both? That if there was a Dien Bien Phu style victory, that would be good, but also tying up all those assets, that would also be a good outcome as well. And if you could achieve both, that would certainly be the optimum.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because that is a view that's considered by most serious historians to be the case. If they could take the base, they would. If they couldn't, they'd stay and tie people up. But, I found documentation that's been translated recently from their document showing that they were digging and attacking us as late as March 22nd, which was, ridiculous because it was all over. But they actually had orders from Hanoi to take the base. I mean, I have quotes from their communique. So I don't know if there was miscommunication. I don't know if maybe some general down the line still felt that it was necessary to do that, but they were sacrificing needlessly, hundreds and hundreds of their troops for no reason. But to answer your question, Mac, yes, the old option play of football, I'll string it out, and if it doesn't work, I'll hand it off. You know?
One other question, Mike, and this comes from an email I got yesterday. One of the things that was illuminated for a friend of mine was the Vietnamese perspective that, and it got said, I want to say, a couple nights ago, that our casualties didn't matter. This is a 1,000-year struggle that we fought for our independence. And so whether, 100 or, 1,000 die, it matters not to us. That we will continue and we will ultimately win. That mindset was not understood by the Americans, and a bit of an epiphany when people hear it even today.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. General Westmoreland wanted Quezon for a different reason. He was getting a lot of heat for injured civilians, as you well know from the documentary and otherwise. And Vietnam, even in the rural areas, were pretty in the rice growing regions were pretty heavily populated. So he wanted to lure a lot of NVA troops out into the open in an area that wasn't populated with civilians and really unleash his B-52s on, which was quite successful actually. You have to give him credit for that. But he was also shocked that they would sacrifice so many people. It never occurred to him that they were willing to sacrifice, the tens of thousands of soldiers to accomplish things that probably didn't have much other than political, gain, transitory political gain. So, it was hard for Americans to believe that that they would do that. And again, they lost 1 million guys. And think of this: they Bao Ninh later on in the 90s wanted to find out what had happened to all these soldiers. They had lost probably 700,000 of them in South Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia. And so the vast majority of the soldiers that the North Vietnamese Army lost are unaccounted for. They're MIAs, essentially. It's a bizarre situation.
It is astounding. I had to run it back. They ran down the casualty figures. 58,000 Americans, 250,000 South Vietnamese soldiers, an estimated 1 million NVA and Viet Cong soldiers were killed. And that number is are those obviously? I mean, I would think Burns does his research well. Do those numbers fall in line with what you've seen?
Yeah, they do, and I've come to the same conclusion independently.
Wow.
A staggering figure though is 210,000 Americans were casualties in that war, either killed, wounded, or MIA. 200. So that's almost a quarter of 1 million right there. If you drive in 2007, I drove from the city away up to Dong Ha on the way to Quezon. And that stretch of road, I'm guessing 10, 15, 20 miles, something like that, is one long military cemetery. As far as you can see, it's the place that they used to call when the French were there, the street without joy. And they have been dying there on that stretch of road for probably since the mid 19th century. But it's the whole country. I'm exaggerating, but so much of the country is military cemeteries everywhere you turn. One thing I might mention too, though, is, the government of the North, when they came into the South, they always talk about liberation and united and everything, but that wasn't the case. You know, it was more like the carpetbaggers of the Civil War in America coming south, and they took over the government. They disbanded the NLF, the VC, because they didn't want their nationalist influence. The provisional government of Vietnam, at the time that they took over, they drove out all the non-communists and persecuted them. And they were very, very strict on the South because they'd been tainted by Western ideas. And that lasted for, until I went over there, even the people lived in relative fear. So, you know, that's another aspect of the, I guess, of the documentary that I'd like to see play out a little differently. I hope they treat that at the end. That what happened to former Arvins and civilians and people that dealt with the West, the education camp, the execution. I hope that's dealt with.
Here's a message from Bob Nielsen, who's a Vietnam guy. He was there 66, 67. Arvin and reeducation camps were sent out to clear minefields, sometimes 10 years and more. From a Viet who was there. Nice re-education. The brutality of what happened after the war, after our involvement ended and the North Vietnamese prevailed in South Vietnam is not something that gets much attention in the United States.
Yeah, and he's absolutely right. That was pretty well documented that Arvin officers were sent out to clear mines with their bare hands. The re-education camps were horrible. My scooter driver in 2007, and I won't mention his name because he was an Arvin who had survived the camp, and he'd lost an eye during the war. But I noticed that his right trigger finger, the top phalanges, was missing, and he wouldn't talk about it. But my friend, my corpsman from Vietnam, Bob Topmiller, Dr. Bob Topmiller, who succumbed to, took his own life after we returned from Vietnam, sadly, due to PTSD. Brilliant guy. He had lived in Vietnam and become a Buddhist before that. And Bob told me that a lot of the Arvin, actually voluntarily cut the end of their trigger finger off as a symbol that they would never raise arms against the government again in order to get time off in the re-education camps. I mean, this is pretty barbaric stuff. But it's symbolic of, how this went down. And one other thing I might mention is, you know, the idea of wandering souls is very important to many, many people in Vietnam. And that is that if a soul, the physical remains of a person aren't buried in Vietnam or honored in Vietnam, in an ancestral grave, something like that, that they wander, and they create a lot of misfortune and different things. And what I wrote in my book was almost 250,000 people fled voluntarily from that country. And I know people are tied to their country because of this principle more than the Vietnamese people. And for them to voluntarily flee and know that they're probably never coming back and going to die in a foreign land gives you an idea just how bad things were.
Another email for you, Mike. Mac, everything I've read about Khe Sanh talks about just the daily grind of incoming casualties, sometimes feelings of helplessness. Two questions. One, what kept them together? Two, how did they keep from going insane? I believe you played a little clip from Ken Rogers from the documentary that Ken had an experience where he felt like he looked into the abyss of insanity. And then I believe it was a photographer said something to him, and he said that voice brought him back, but he felt like he looked into it. So I'm curious, was it leadership, as we've talked about so often, that kept people together, and how do you keep from going insane in a situation like that? Nothing like easy questions, Mike. Welcome to the program.
You know, I think I touched on the second part before. You know, I don't know how we got that idea out of our minds. You know, if I had to say, Quezon, Under Siege was very unusual for a military unit,
right,
because we all lived in individual holes. I say individual, you know, maybe a few people too, a bunker that we dug ourselves, and they were very shoddily made little runway matting, little Marston matting from World War II, for God's sakes, and some sandbags and different things. But, you know, we never had any military formations. We were never out together, you know, like you would in a normal military setting. The word was spread, you know, word of mouth, running from one hole to another. Consequently, I think more than anything else, and this is true of all wars and all soldiers, you know, we were doing it for each other, you know. And in Quezon, it was even more of a microcosm, you know. Ken Rogers will probably tell you, the guys at Bravo, you know, if you had a machine gun emplacement on the line, and I was right behind Bravo. The Quezon perimeter was very narrow then, and their lines were very close to the command center. We were only about 300 feet from the command center, and the NVA were no more than 300 meters from that. So it was a very tight fit. But I think, you know, it's that thing where you're just going to stay here and you're going to do it, and you're not going to crack because you need to be part of helping somebody else. If I can mention the for your listener, the one time I think we all crack a little bit. When I got back from Quezon Village, I managed to get on a helicopter, and I was in a hurry to get out of there. And I left everything I had except my rifle and a bandolier of ammunition in my helmet. And so I left my gas mask there. And, you know, I'd gone down there TAD, so I didn't have anything at base. And when I returned to the base was a mess. The rockets had come in and blown up our ammo dump, and half the base was missing. I have to tell you, flying in on that 34, I saw this smoke, and it was a clear day when we were up in the sky, and I thought it was fog because there was a lot of fog in Quezon. But it was the whole base had turned into this inferno, or half of it. And I found my unit, and a couple of nights later, some gas came in. I don't know whether it was exploding from the ammo dump or the NVA just shot it in. But it was CS. It wasn't lethal, but I didn't know that. And there were a lot of rumors that the NVA were going to use nerve gas on us, and they were going to use different agents that would make you blind or, you know, vomit to death. And I remember the rumors particularly. And I panicked. Everybody put their gas mask on, and the gas started seeping down into this bunker where I was. And I grabbed my M16, and I said, I'm out of here. And I headed up the hole, a hatch out of there. And my friend Steve Ward grabbed me and said, where are you going? And I said, I hate to say this. I said, I'm going to go find the first guy I don't know, the first Marine I don't know, and take his gas mask away. And I have to do it at gunpoint. I was panicked, Steve grabbed me, and two of those guys started punching me in the jaw, which was good, and threw a blanket on me, some water on it and whatnot. But I'm ashamed of that, but, you know, it was the only time I lost it at Vietnam, and I don't know what I would have done if I'd gotten topside, but, you know, it happens to us all, and fortunately I survived because of my friends.
Interesting. You know, people talk about, you know, that poll, who do you fight for? You know, you fight for, you know, and it sounds so corny because you hear it so often. You fight for that Marine on your left and on your right, but you know, history is replete with those examples of that becomes some of the closest people that you'll ever be around in your life. Maybe you don't realize it that early into the relationship, but those are strong, powerful relationships. The my guest again, who's been very, very gracious with his time this morning with us. His name is Mike Archer. He was a communicator, born and raised in Oakland, father and brother Marines, and in both Vietnam and World War II. And Mike went off as a communicator to wound up at Quezon, and Ken Rogers kind of hooked us together. The as the series plays out, Mike, what are your as a Vietnam guy, what do you hope that this series achieves?
Wow, that's a good question. You know, I think it is achieving it. I think that we need to address, and you brought it out, Mac. You know, this thing went, you know, even knowing anything about the North Vietnamese and the VC, it went for 50 years without. Without coming to light, and the feelings of most vets who served in combat there are not fully developed. And I think I don't want to say that we were pariahs, but I think we feel that way in some sense. And I think that people understood, and you know, the frustration of the war. You know, I'll take a different tack. I could understand people seeing us treating the Vietnamese civilians as badly as we did, and not consider us to be decent people. And I think Burns, in all honesty, I don't like to believe that we did these things, but we did, and I don't like to believe that we, you know, that we hated these people. I think somebody on the show, Musgrave, I think his name was, brought up a really good point. He said, he started to say we hated these people, but what he really said, and he corrected it, was we hated fearing these people. And I think that was a perfect example. So, you know, I hope that all comes out, and I hope in the end there's a better understanding of, you know, that bad things happen in war. The best way to avoid them is to avoid war.
Interesting. All right, tell us, for people interested in reading about Khe Sanh, give us a little thumbnail of your first two works. What is each one about?
Yeah, thanks, Matt. The first one came out in 2004. It's called A Patch of Ground, Khe Sanh Remembered. And it's pretty much a straight memoir. And, you know, it was a cathartic thing. I hate to use that word, but it's a good word. You know, it was a cleansing thing. And you know, I really believe the old adage, I guess, you know, that the truth will set me free. When I got back to American River College, in fact, I just lived in the library. I just studied history religiously because I thought it would help me understand why my friend had died and why what had happened to me. And I guess in the end it did, you know, but it took many, many years to do that. One of the things I might mention, though, you touched on, it's very important, and is that you mentioned how I had Steve Orr early on, but people have the Internet now. And I couldn't develop either of these subjects because I didn't know where any of these people were until the Internet came into existence. So even, you know, even if I hadn't been emotionally ready to write, I couldn't have found these folks without the web. And I did find them fast. And so I finished that book. And then my readers started contacting me saying, I mentioned Tom Mahoney, my buddy, and started asking me, what about Mahoney? What happened to him? And I'll be damned if I didn't know. I mean, I knew he was shot and left behind, you know, involuntarily. There were great, his platoon leader, Lieutenant Frank Ahern, and his buddies, they refused to leave him. They disobeyed an order from a future commandant of the Marine Corps, Robert Barrow, who was commanding temporarily. He was regimental commander of 1-9, was temporarily commanding the case on battlefield that day. But eventually a darkness left him. So it was very dramatic. But I didn't know how Tom had died. And so I started seeking records off in the Library of Congress in North Vietnamese translation and found out the sad, very sad story that he'd got the Dear John letter. I'd known that when I'd arrived home, and faced his parents, but I never really tied the two together, I think. But he'd gotten a Dear John letter 2 days before, and he'd written me a letter witnessing the destruction of Khe Sanh. He could hear the explosions on his hill reverberating up the hill from the base. We were destroying, Marines were destroying everything there was, and then a tank trucked out of there one night at midnight. He was just, like we all were when we found out, very discouraged that such enormous sacrifices had been made, and just to walk away 3 months later. As it developed, I ended up writing, The Long Goodbye, and it's a fantastic story in that once I started developing this, I was almost led, almost involuntarily, on this quest back to Vietnam. I'd mentioned Bob Totmiller, a corpsman, who had become a Buddhist and made many contacts there and went back, and he said, let's do things the Vietnamese way, and I said, well, what's that? Because quite frankly, the government wasn't looking very hard at the time. They did a cursory search on the hill in the mid-90s. And anyway, long story short, Doc said, I call him Doc because he was our foreman. He said, let's get a telepath and go find him, because the Vietnamese, many Vietnamese believe that. And I don't. And I said, well, this is crazy. But I went along, and it was, I won't get into too much detail, but Mr. Thuan, Bu Than, who went up to the hill with us with his entourage, and it was fascinating. The story's in the book, but it was a real eye-opener. And then I got to meet several NVA, and then I eventually tracked down one of the guys who killed him, and interviewed him three times in it. So one thing led to another, as you can see. One little door opened and another one opened ahead of it. So
did you find his remains?
Here's what happened. I found out that I got really angry with the DTMO, the Defense Department, the POW MIA command that's looking for him. And so was Congress. And in 2013, they completely shook it up. They weren't doing it right. As an example, there's two knolls on Hill 881 South. And incidentally, Hill 881 South had been heavily contested in the spring of 1967 when the Marines took it. A lot of Marines died on that hill, Tom being the last one. But there's two knolls. There's a main position and a one to the south about 500 meters. And the U.S. government was digging on the wrong hill. And I kept sending them information that I'd gotten from not only American, but North Vietnamese eyewitnesses. I looked at all the command chronologies, all the North Vietnamese military records I could find. And they wouldn't listen to me. Well, then they had a big shakeup, and now they're listening. And so what I did was I arranged to have Lieutenant Ahern, Tom's platoon commander, and his squad leader, Corporal Tom Northrup, to join them on the hill in the summer of 14. And they located the site. There's pictures and things on my website if people want to take a look at this. So now I got a letter pretty much apologizing, which it was fine. I didn't want an apology. I just wanted some results from what's called the Joint PIA MIA Accountability Command, saying that we agree that he's in this, probably in this 60 meter by 60 meter area, and they're going back in April of 18 next year, and they're going to take the full crew, the archaeologists, the probably 100 local diggers, start sifting. And so hopefully this will come to fruition.
Wow.
After all these years, yeah.
Wow. Well, first of all, Mike, thanks for doing this morning.
You bet.
I've thoroughly enjoyed it. I hope you don't mind in the future if I bug you. But you provide a unique viewpoint as kind of like the one Ken provides in terms of you're a storyteller. So when you look at something like Ken Burns, I think you see some of the layers that many of us don't, because you have had to limit subject matter, and you do realize there's only certain amount of certain number of topics that you can treat effectively, given 300, 400 pages, or given 10 hours of television, and you have to choose, you make choices in that, but also your experience in Vietnam, very interesting. So thank you very much for doing this.
Oh, Mac, it's been a real pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
All right, we'll do it again. Have a great day. Thank you.
Hope so. Bye-bye.
You there have it. Mike Archer. We're going to take a break. Mike Musselman, All Mike Radio, coming up next here on this is a cool job. In case you can't tell, this is a cool job. You meet smart veterans like that, and they have incredible stories. And I think a lot of times what they do post-Marine is just as much, sometimes more compelling, as what they do when they're Marine. So we're going to take a break. Gunner will join us next. More of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on the All Warrior Radio Network. Are you looking for the perfect gift for somebody who's in the military? For a first responder? For a hunter? For an outdoorsman? Or somebody that just likes cool military stuff? I've got the perfect gift for you. The Battle Mug. Starts as 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at battlemug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out. Battlemug.com.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.